This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
And I'm a little groggy. Today is Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. I was in New York for work, and then I was a couple days off and had a long weekend in Seattle. Got back last night. It's early morning here on the left coast. Rebecca was captaining the good ship, RNMG, not by herself, but was the most senior person. Doing a bunch of stuff. We're back. We're talking about today underrated authors. This came out of a conversation we had in anticipation of the publication of Heaven's Grocery Store by James McBride when we were both looking forward to it. And I think we had both read it and liked it and really thought it was something special. But before the deluge of sales and accolades for that book, principally in the form of it was still top eight. Top 10 in hardcover fiction last week when I looked at PWs. I haven't looked at this week PWs. It was both Amazon and Barnes & Noble's Book of the Year. I did a mini tour of bookstores while I was in New York, in Seattle and environs. Face out, front table on almost every store. The only reason I'm saying almost is I didn't actually do a check mark, you know, check by check with my checklist. But it was out there with shelf talkers and people were buying it. I saw it in somebody's hands. So McBride has ascended to, I don't even know, I'm not even sure where to put him now. I think he may have taken the commercial literary crown from Celeste Ng. I guess I'll throw that to you first.
I think he might have, or he's right up there. There was a big profile of him in the New York Times this week that I was just like, okay, this makes it really official. Like, I have to fully come off my argument that James McBride is under-celebrated. Yeah. But he has sold more than a million copies of the book, and the profile is wonderful. I'll find a link and drop it here in the show notes. But he doesn't know what to make of this. He's still very much living like he was living before he sold a floppity jillion books and won all of the awards. I was just really charmed by the way that he speaks about what the success means, what his writing practice is like, and what the rest of his life looks like. He said, you know, when you've been a David your whole life, you kind of don't know what to do when you become Goliath. And I imagine that's a huge thing to be wrapping your head around. But yeah, I think, I don't know if he and if he has knocked Celeste Ng off the podium or if the podium has just kind of like divided now, because Ng does, you know, a kind of different thing. I think there's a significant overlap in the Venn diagram between their readerships, but it's not a circle. McBride is more literary, and I think he's working on more levels. He's working on more levels than you typically get to work on and be this commercially successful.
I think that's right.
And it's just really great to see. This was a, we should talk about who else is underrated or who's maybe going to come to the top of our under-celebrated list now that McBride is no longer there.
Yep. Okay. So that was the motivation. I have a list of 12 or 13 in just a minute, but let's take our first sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
One of the advantages of coming at this like we came at it, which is James McBride was not, we did not discover James McBride, you and I. I mean, he had a Pulitzer Prize. Good Lord Bird had a well-regarded, if not hugely seen, adaptation starring big-time stars in the form of Ethan Hawke. So I think ours was really more about the delta of where he, what he does and where he could be, right? So this isn't like we are, let me put it this way, I'll speak for myself. I am not trolling the frontlist catalog of, say, Soft Skull Press.
Right.
To look at, I'm not Lib, right? Lib has a totally different list than we would have. We're talking about the kinds of books that we've read and talk about. You know, if you listen to the show, you know what we're talking about. But feel like they can jump up a level or two. Now, could that be from level A to 1A? Sure. I think that's sort of McBridean move. Could it be from book people know them but others don't? Sure. Could it be that some non-book people, so you're saying that it's not about, you know, diamonds in the rough. I'm not an outdoors person. I'm not going to find diamonds in the rough. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, and you know, and I am an outdoors person, but there aren't a lot of diamonds in the moss. Although maybe that'll be the title of my memoir. Yeah, I did not go for hipster picks here. It's not the kind of reader that I am, but I also didn't think that was really in the spirit of the list. So yeah, I've got, it sounds like we came at this from the same angle of folks that have had some success in like some of the quadrants of, or some of the areas of literary success, but that I feel are overdue for a breakout. And I've got six that I'm like ready to make very full-throated cases for, and then another 8 to 10 names.
I don't have much of a full-throated anything in me today, so maybe between the two of them we can scrape together an interesting list. Mine are not ordered in any particular
mine
way.
Mine aren't either.
I guess the one I was most interested to talk with you about off the dome, again, these are names, I think all of these names people have heard us talk about in some region before, is Linda Holmes. Because I've read Emily Henry, I've read Curtis Sittenfeld, and I see no reason that Linda Holmes shouldn't sell like those people do. I prefer Linda Holmes' book to those. I don't know. Maybe it's not sentimental enough. I don't know what it is, but I don't see why Linda Holmes' books, I prefer them to both of those people. And
I
maybe I am not the obvious and center of the target for commercial romance, but I like Linda Holmes, and let's sell some copies. I think she's doing fine, but I would like to see, you know, a different kind of sales trajectory and more people to read Linda Holmes. Am I wrong about that? What do you think about that?
No, you're very right. I love that you came out of the gate with Linda Holmes. I didn't think about her for this because I went for folks that have more books, and I wonder if maybe that is part of why Linda Holmes hasn't broken out. She's not on the new book every 6 months.
That's true. Every pattern. May 1st.
Right. You know, it's not like April and November that a lot of the commercial romance authors are on. And the books, you said sentimental. I was thinking they're not cutesy. They don't pander to, there's no pandering in any of them. And not that all commercial romance panders, don't at me. But I think that maybe one of the things that makes those books work for us might be the same thing that makes them not work for the broader, like, commercial romance illustrated cover kind of audience. Although they're wonderful, they're a little less happily ever after-y. I think they are happy for now. But they do have happy endings. They're less dramatic. Like, and more realistic. And I also wonder if that is a thing that she gets knocked for from the romance community that makes it work for me. Because having read a good amount of romance, not nearly as much as some folks, like, I can't do a whole bunch of traditional romance novels in a row because I get over the rhythm of it. Like, oh yeah, okay, they've met. Now here comes the part where they're going to have a fight, and then there's going to be some sort of resolution. And that, like, predictability turns me off. And that Holmes's stories are more grounded. Like, they feel to me the way that real people talk to each other. The kinds of conflicts that real couples have in their relationships, or that real individuals have as they're trying to sort out how to be part of a couple, especially later on in life. And so I don't know if that's just those differences that are significant, that are pluses for me, and I think pluses for you. I wonder if those are working against her in the commercial landscape. But I thought that's a great one to start off with.
Thank you so much. That's our show today. Thank you for listening.
Eight minutes, and I've agreed with you, and we've done our jobs here.
I've been gone for 10 days. I got one agreement. We're going to shut it down for the week. I got some PTO still to burn. Let's go.
I'm glad you're back. I'm ready to agree with you about things today.
Yeah. There we go.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
Today. All right. What do you want to do?
Okay. I want to start with Barbara Kingsolver, shortlisted for the Pulitzer for the Poisonwood Bible. She won it for Demon Copperhead. Oprah has picked multiple of her titles. She sells like hotcakes. She was the first person to win the Women's Prize for Fiction twice. And yet, when we have conversations, and I include you and me in the we here.
So you just hear she's underrated, just like in this particular Slack huddle, she's underrated. Well, is that what you're saying, for real?
No, I know. I think we're included in it. But when the book world has conversations about important authors or people that deserve recognition, she's rung the two bells that are really difficult to ring at the same time of both commercial and literary success in terms of acclaim and winning awards. But she doesn't come to the top of our minds when, like, in the publishing world, when we talk about who are the big successful, important novelists of the day. And she writes about serious things. Like, this one is kind of a mystery to me. My only working theory is what I'm going to call the Ann Patchett theory. And it's that she makes it look too easy, which is actually quite hard to pull off. She was one of my first ones. What do you think about this? I hear some skepticism.
I guess what I'm thinking is James McBride just got to the point where Kingsolver was, right? She has prizes. She sells a ton of books. Demon Copperhead is selling, for both of them, what would be next? A Nobel Prize? I'm not kidding. There's kind of nowhere else to go. This is more like people rock in Paris Review tote bags on the F trains. Are not thrilled that a new Kingsolver is coming out.
there's that, and also just like in my civilian life, when people talk about like authors that they're waiting for their next book or people that they really love, like clearly a lot of people are looking forward to Barbara Kingsolver and a lot of people buy her books, but like somehow she just hasn't cracked that, like that top tier. And so I think she should be in that top tier of conversation. It's not that she's not celebrated. It's just that I think she is not quite celebrated enough for what she's done.
That, I mean, sure, I could believe you with that. I guess I remember this story, though, that maybe our radar is broken on how well-known she is amongst the,
possible.
Let's call it the Book Club Plus. Because once you're a book club favorite, which I think she is, there's kind of nowhere else to go unless you're going to fourth wing it, which these books never are going to do.
Oh, like, no.
She was right up there with Lessons in Chemistry and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. And how many tomorrows are there? I guess just three in Shakespeare.
It's so three. You got it.
Yeah. There's nowhere, I kind of feel like there's nowhere else to go unless it is you're going to be in the Percival, Everett, Teju, Cole, Jesmyn, Ward, Zadie. For us, that ring, now I agree with you, she has not yet penetrated that membrane of our sort of mitochondrial importance and how we think about her amongst us. But I think that's a very slight difference. Now, I think there is some movement there, but that seems to me a very slight difference. Because I'm not even sure does McBride get the thing that you want for Kingsolver?
I think he's on the way.
Yeah.
But he's also got fewer books. Like, Kingsolver's just been, they've both been at it for a long time, but we've had a lot more examples of
familiar
Kingsolver.
Familiar breeds, shruggy shoulders, right? Like,
sometimes,
kind of know what they are at this point. Copperhead's pretty weird. I mean,
she picks, this is where she goes literary, and I think it works against her in that popular consciousness, is that she does pick obscure stuff. She picks less accessible topics for her book, and you do have to do a little work. It's not homeworky reading by any stretch, but you've got to, be paying attention. You got to be awake when you're doing your Kingsolver, and that is also not for everybody. I have real questions too about the space between the number of Barbara Kingsolver books that are sold and the number of Barbara Kingsolver books that are read. And I think if more of them were read and like genuinely appreciated, you're right. Yes. It's a fine
citing data. Like, we can't know what from you right there.
We're talking vibes here.
All right.
But that it is a fine distinction, but I'd want to feel the dial continue to go up for her.
This is a weird point to make. I do sometimes think, no, not yours, the one I'm about to make. Yours was minor.
Weird, too.
Can we talk about sometimes names are important, like the name of the author?
Oh,
like,
sure.
I don't think Barbara is a cool name.
It sounds like an old lady name. Yeah.
It sounds older than it is, right? Like my next pick I'm going to go to kind of, I'm going to free associate here. Kevin Wilson, I think,
also
is
underread. On my list.
But Kevin is sort of like a 90s, like a joke. Like it's a kid from Home Alone. I'm not kidding. Teju is an awesome name.
Uh-huh,
James McBride, it's a Coulson, Jesmyn, Zadie. These are cool names. Kevin and Barbara are not cool names. They aren't.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. Yeah, especially, I'm glad Kevin Wilson is on yours. Do you want to pivot there and we'll talk about him?
Well, I guess I don't even know what to do with this. So Family Fang, Now Is Not the Time of the Panic, Nothing to See Here, all very cool, strange. I guess, what genre are these? I mean, they're literary fiction, but they're comic, surrealist, dark, but they're also accessible at the same time. Like, these are extremely readable books.
That's almost the exact language in my notes. The books are fun and weird in an accessible way. And I think that maybe, in addition to the fact that Kevin is not a cool sounding name, and I do think you're onto something.
It's hard
there.
To remember. Kevin Wilson is like, you were in sixth grade with him and now he's an accountant.
Yeah. His khakis are definitely pleated.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. Love Kevin. Haven't seen him forever.
Right, yeah, the name is a lot more straightforward and like milquetoast than the contents of the book, for sure. I think maybe he suffers from being ahead of his time. Like, The Family Fang was 2011, and the adaptation came out in 2015.
Yeah.
And that thing has the flavor of a streaming series in such a big way.
I totally agree.
Now Is Not the Time to Panic is all about Like, it's just a monument to 90s nostalgia and the weirdness, especially the 90s satanic panic situation. That's like so ripe for this moment where elder millennials, where like all kinds of media is pandering to elder millennials' nostalgia for the 90s. And I am so in the center of that dartboard. Like, please make this. I want the needle drops in that soundtrack. And it's just, it's not so weird that it would turn people off. I think Nothing to See Here is the weirdest one, with the kids, you know, like going into flames unexpectedly.
Yeah, I mean, the cover of the book has the bottom right. half of a middle grader's torso on fire.
Yeah, spontaneous combustion, but like yeah. a perfect little world feels not too far off from like how Severance works as a mm-hmm. show. Like people
yeah, these
living
all could
in
be
a
Hulu adaptations starring right. Jesse Eisenberg. We need one of these to happen.
Yeah.
We just
and
do.
Some of the, and you know, Kingsolver also, just to go back up there, not a Signal adaptation.
No,
and I think
true.
That works against folks for, you know, it's hard to feel like somebody's fully celebrated when there's mm-hmm. Not a Signal adaptation. But Kevin Wilson was in my top five for this.
I mean, he's had Read with Jenna book picks. Like, all of them have New York Times bestseller. Family Fang was best book of the year. Mm-hmm. This is not underknown necessarily within certain circles, but I feel like there's a wider kind of.
Yeah.
There's a wider kind of readership for this, and I wonder if it's the readership for this that it may be give people a different flavor than we get other places, are the kind of people that don't read as many books, like a 27-year-old postgraduate dude, frankly. I mean, not when to cater to them, but I think that kind of person would love these kind of books.
I totally agree.
Don't know about them.
Yeah, when I fill in as a bibliologist for our TBR service, which like short plug for that, it's like Stitch Fix for books. I use Kevin Wilson titles all the time because they are underread and underknown, and we're checking against people's Goodreads lists, and he's hardly ever there. And I'm reading, you know, like other authors and other titles and the kinds of things they're looking for. And like, Kevin Wilson is perfect for this. How is it that you don't know about him? And now I'm going to spend probably more time than I should thinking about like what. Should he have made his pen name in order
to
have...
I don't know. I have no sense. But there's a scene in the movie High Fidelity where it's a kind of a busy, humming Saturday at mm-hmm. Championship Vinyl. And Cusack says, I'm now going to sell 8 copies by the Beta Band. And he puts on the Beta Band AP. And a bunch of like hipster dudes start nodding their head and they're like, what is this? It's good. And he goes, I know. I feel like Kevin Wilson is the Beta Band of this. Like, you know, they don't know, but if you can give it to them, they're really going to be into it. And I think that's not a Kevin Wilson problem. I think that's a book world problem. That's a too many books problem. That's a marketing, you know, just the difficulty. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had 20 meetings with publishers over the last 10 days, and I have very much the difficulty and challenges of getting the word out there about certain books, and it feels like this is the kind of thing that we're talking about, because the books are good, the books are there, I think people would like
great.
them, and I don't know that any kind of name would help you. Maybe that's
I think that's part of it. Like, if he had a quirky name and he looked like a barista from like your favorite coffee shop in Williamsburg, you know, if that's the author pick on there, I think it helps convey the quirkiness of these titles. Like, it's hard to design a book cover in general. It's really hard to design a good cover for a book that is like both zany and also very accessible. Kevin Wilson is just a vibe that, like, once you know it. And you mm-hmm. love it. But it's tough, man. I really would love to see him break out in a really meaningful way. And like, can somebody please get on the Now Is Not the Time to Panic adaptation for me?
All right. That was my second one. What else you got?
Okay. Louise Erdrich.
Okay. So you're really like, who's not in the Hall of Fame and should mm-hmm. be? That's where you start.
That's where I started, too,
because like, here's the thing that I have trouble with that about. And you make your reason why she should be, and then I'll do the counter, I guess.
Okay. More interesting. She has all the very well-deserved critical acclaim. She's won the Pulitzer. She's won the National Book Award. She's won the National Book Critics Circle Award multiple times. So she's like, that's the triple crown of literary fiction. But she's never picked up commercial steam. There's no Oprah picks. And despite the fact that these books are very book clubbable.
Are there no Okra or Reese or anything, huh?
No. You looked at that? There might be a Reese something, but there was no Okra.
I don't think so. It wasn't the sentence and the one before that. It's been a while.
Yeah, and the Roundhouse is one of the more book clubbable recent ones. Right. Yeah. They're incredibly discussable. There's a lot to chew on. The writing is good, but not hard. And that is uncommon. Good and not hard.
Yeah.
And there's no Signal adaptation of any of hers, which is criminal at this point. Yeah. But yeah, she's won the literary acclaim, but these books should sell like crazy. She should be selling like Barbara Kingsolver. I don't know why she's not.
I think she's weirder and actually harder. The topics are more difficult than Kingsolver. And that matters when it comes to big time sales.
Yeah,
even the McBride.
And I wonder,
it's ultimately fairly happy, it comes to a different kind of place and people prefer that. The Erdricks tend to be kind of a bummer. I mean, not surprisingly, but it does have I think there's a downdraft when you tend to write about more serious subjects.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's fair. But also, I wonder if the publisher is trying not to feel like they're sacrificing or undermining her literary bona fides, because the titles and the packaging are also always very literary fiction.
Yeah.
And slightly lighter packaging with some titles that are a little more straight ahead on what the book is about, or synopses that sound a little bit lighter that convey this book is you will be more challenged.
I'm not sure they are lighter, though. I guess that's the central question. I mean, you could, the sentence, it's pretty light packaging, but it's a ghost story set in COVID. That's a weird kind of a bummer of a book. I'm not sure what else you do with that.
Yeah. It's heavier than Ann Patchett.
Yes.
But it's not...
Yes. You're never
it's not homework reading.
Like Patchett.
Yeah, no, and I don't think they should, but there's a lot of space between the Patchett packaging and the Erdrick packaging, and I think we could move a couple ticks closer to Patchett packaging and be both true to what Erdrick is doing and also casting a wider net of commercial readership for her.
Yeah, I think Erdrick is an interesting case because she's a person, though, and I guess this is one thing that prevents me from being super excited or, super using one of my spots to say underrated. Mm-hmm. Is that if it was announced next year that she won the Nobel Prize,
oh, totally.
Be shocked.
Yeah. But would her book sales tick up in the way that they should because of how great
does
she
anyone,
is? Also, probably not. No.
Probably Abdul Razak Gurna selling on a percentage basis many more copies, but on an absolute basis,
right.
would someone like Erdrick even notice? I'm not sure about that. Where do I want to go next?
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode.
I don't know that I guess if I'm sticking. Well, recency bias, and there aren't that many books. Well, there's a few, but I think I'm ready to give Adura Keeb somebody's crown.
Yes!
In terms of
yes!
cultural criticism and essays.
You're coming out of the gate with all my arguments today.
I'm not sure, or maybe just like, if you're going to ask me whose book of cultural criticism would I most like to read on subject of their choosing, I don't know that I have a draft pick over a Hanif Adura Keeb at this point.
Either.
I don't know how you do. And I guess I'll slide in. I'm looking at essayists too. And Ross Gay's pretty well known. But he's publishing these little tiny books from Algonquin. And I love Algonquin. But they're kind of slight, and I like them slight, but and I don't know how you get from, and I don't know that either Gay and Adura Keeb are not doing the same things, but I feel like they're waiting in the wings to, I don't know, be, both of them could be offered a New York Times column tomorrow, right? This happens to writers like, you know, Roxane Gay got one of these. People get these. I would be thrilled if one of them took Pamela Paul's slot. Lord knows that would not be But like both of them, and not to say like I don't even know who's the cultural critic they would knock off in King of the Mountain because they don't exist.
There's not really
some TikTok
one,
influencer that I don't know about. But none of them write regularly for The New Yorker, I don't think. And they should, or The Atlantic or something like that. And I think they're both that good. But Adura Keeb, I guess, feels like because the subject matter, especially with this most recent one, is pop culture. It's basketball. Mm-hmm. I could see him one doing about video games or TV or movies and really enter into that space. I guess Klosterman was in 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Klosterman is the right example for him, that Adura Keeb is interested in pop culture, but also like he's a poet and something of a philosopher and brings those lenses to the forms of art that are in the mainstream. You know, like I follow him on Instagram, and the day after the Grammys, he did like a really fascinating multi-slide thing about sort of like little known history bits about Tracy Chapman's career. And I was like, where is this? Like, he's had a music podcast, but why has The Ringer not hired Hanif Adura Keeb?
It's too much. I think it's too artistic/cerebral. It's not a couple of smart people sitting around bullshitting to being the smartest person in their friend group, which I think The Ringer does the best. I think he's the smartest person of a group of a bunch of your smartest friends.
He's the smartest
person in that room.
There have been a bunch of big profiles of him. I've read them in, I think, GQ, The New York Times, and The Washington Post in the last week as this new book is coming out. And this might be the moment. Like, there's always this year. But I'm glad you mentioned him and Ross Gay in the same breath, because I have started to think about them as similar writers as well. Like it feels like their projects in terms of like what they are concerned about with art and humanity are similar, even though they're coming at it from different angles. Gaze is a lot like warmer. But my notes are just like, why the F isn't Oprah all over Ross Gay? It's this, or Reese, or any of them, like this marriage of poetry and philosophy and finding beauty in even the difficult moments of life. I did hear him on Glennon Doyle's podcast, and he was one of the only men that's ever been invited to be on that show. And I was like, oh, this is great. I wonder if this will be part of that show. Has a huge audience. Maybe this will break him out. Those books do sell. I wonder if this is, I think it might be kind of in the same zone as Linda Holmes. Like he's just you're doing a little more work and it's not quite as commercial and you get docked for it. Because the books look very commercial, but they don't go down as easy as the covers make you think they're going to.
Mm-hmm. So that was my next one. Let's do a few more here. What else you got?
Okay. Kevin Wilson Erdrich. Those were my, those are my big ones. I do think, I just have to mention Ann Patchett's name because she makes it look so easy that how hard the work she does is underappreciated. So I'm just going to say her name there. Can I get a posthumous pick? I need to talk about James Salter.
Yeah, this is a good spot for it. I didn't think about the, we'll call it the Melville Award for posthumous ascension, but talk about Salter.
Yeah, he's commonly referred to as a writer's writer, and probably anyone who is described that way, or it's like generally agreed in the world of books, the person is a writer's writer. That person is probably underappreciated. Writer's writer and underappreciated go hand in hand. And it's hard to think of a more writerly writer's writer than Salter. Like, other writers talked about how he wrote great books and also, like, they were fun to read and the stories move and the sentences are among the best sentences in American literature. He's doing craft at a really high level and it's accessible and it doesn't feel like homework. Like, he won the Penn Faulkner, but that only matters in like an inside baseball industry kind of way. He never got any of the big awards. And I did go back and look. Light Years, I think, is the most award foddery of his novels. It came out in 75, so could have contended for like the 1976 awards. But that year, the National Book Award went to J.R. by William Gaddis, and the Pulitzer went to Humboldt's Gift by Saul Bellow. I don't hear anybody talking about any of those anymore, but we're talking about James Salter. Like, every now and then, there's still like someone reflecting on what it was like to work with James Salter. You see those pieces come up. There are no adaptations, but like some of these, especially Light Years and The Hunters, are really good candidates for a prestige spin. Solo Faces
Timothy
started.
Timothy Chalamet starting as the pilot
in The Hunters.
Hunters.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
And like Solo Faces started as a screenplay. Robert That's Redford nuts. Had commissioned it, and Salter and then they killed it, and so Salter turned it into a novel. And like you could see a small studio like A24 taking, which is, increasingly a big studio, taking a sport and a pastime out for like an updated spin. And it could be, that could be like a sexy summer indie movie in a way. I even think I just want to find a way to justify some James Salter love. But I think if you squint the right way, there's a version of Life is Meals that he wrote with his wife that looks kind of like an American version of The Taste of Things.
Yeah, it could be. And the Sally Rooney verse would have their mind blown by an adaptation of A Sport and a Pastime.
Oh, my God.
Y'all are ready for that. And maybe it's, I don't know, in our modern sensibility, there's elements of that might be more challenging than others. But I'm always here to keep the eternal flame lit for one James.
Thank
Salter.
You. Who else is on your list?
I've got an entree into the let's make this person a dad book staple. The kinds of people I want something for my dad that likes engineering and he likes Noma Agrawal, who I think I talked about before. She wrote this book. Her most recent book is called Nuts and Bolts: 7 Small Inventions That Changed the World. There's room in the Steven Johnson-like tent for this. Mm-hmm. Her 2021 book was called How Was That Built? The Hidden Stories Behind Big Structures. She's a structural engineer herself. She has an appreciation for, it's called Nuts and Bolts. Like, there's a whole chapter on a hex nut and why they matter and why they're important and how they change the world. The stories behind the buildings. She herself has worked on many notable buildings, most notably probably for those of us that barely know architecture, is the Shard over in London. And they're great and would be great gift books for the kinds of people in your life that like books, but they also want it to be pretty practical or feel grounded in the material world around them. And sometimes that's the dads and the dads in spirit. She went from Bloomsbury to Hodder, which I think is also a Norton imprint. I would love to see the next one be Viking or Penguin or I don't know where else to go here, but this is a good one to add to your, I like to read about things and why the things in our life matter and the people who make them. And she's also very attuned to inclusion and the kinds of inventors that don't get their stories told. So Noma Agrawal, the glow up, I'm excited to someday see, or I would also be happy to keep reading one of these books every couple years, but I think there's another level for there for that those titles to go to.
That's a good one. I have some kind of in that zone, two essayists, memoirs that I think are not packaged as well as they could be to reach a wider audience. Both Melissa Phoebos and Gia Tolentino.
Interesting.
New Yorker kind of commentary writers, but they're also really concerned, especially Tolentino, with pop culture and politics in a way that, like, they are fluent in pop culture and can, you know, write very highbrow kinds of essays, but I think they can write things that a broader audience could certainly access and be into. And my only theory about this, and I have no idea if it holds any like real water or not, is that the kinds of people that were early on the Melissa Phoebos and Gia Tolentino train, like maybe the publishers are concerned about turning those original like OG hipster readers off if they package them as more commercially accessible. Do you get to feel less smart if now your favorite essayists get packaged as if they're intended for a mass audience instead of just for the smarty smarts? And I do think that happens in publishing. I don't know if that's what's going on with the two of them, but every time I read them, I'm like, why are these people not on all the podcasts I listen to everywhere? Why are they not popping up in, you know, the New York Times op-ed pages? Why are these women not household names among the kinds of people that we turn to? Like, what has qualified Pamela Paul, just to get on the hobby horse for a second, to like be a commentator about anything other than the world of books and reading? Why is that op-ed page not going to somebody like Gia Tolentino or Melissa Phoebos or Hanif Abdurraqib? There's just a lot that they have to offer. And I just think that there's a bigger audience for the ways that they think about the world than their publishers are giving them access to.
Yeah. All right. Well, the rest of mine are kind of side notes, but so I'm going to leave it there for now. Anything else you wanted to get off hot take off real quick, like how Barbara Kingsolver isn't well known enough?
Well, the reviews of last year's new novels from Jesmyne Ward and Lauren Groff made me think that there are some people who are just not properly understanding things. So I'm going to say,
what was Lauren Groff? I can't remember what Lauren Groff's last book was. Oh, right, not Matrix. Good Lord, I can see the cover.
Wait, don't tell me.
Oh, The Vaster Wilds. Boy, I am operating at like 70% speed. Cool.
And then just names to toss out: Jill McCorkle and Elizabeth McCracken are on my list, and Kiese Lehmann.
Cool. All right, Rebecca, we'll talk. I'm going to talk to you like three times in the next 72 hours.
Yeah, it's a lot of podcasting this week.
So, all right. Thanks, everybody. bookriot.com/listen for show notes. Podcast at bookriot.com. The Patreon at patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. All those links are there in the show notes. We'll talk to you all soon.
Have a good one.